right. Well, thanks, Brian. It was great. We are honored to have Dr. Gehrman with us on staff. Just the best choice we've made in a long, long time, calling someone on. But it's the right song by the group. So think Don Henley and the Eagles. I know. Although I was telling, I'm from the edge of North Dakota, and let's hear it for North Dakota State University's finest, who is doing really well for the Eagles. If you're a fan of football at all, that made some sense to you, and such. And they're doing really well. So all of North Dakota is very proud of NDSU. But thank you for letting me come and be with you again. It's been a bit of time, but thank you. It's nice to see familiar faces, some new faces also. As I got up there, we're going to be taking a look at Romans. So if you have Romans handy, if you've got a text with you, open her up and we'll go to Romans, and we'll get you a text here also. If I'm sure we have an extra Bible or two that we can use and share. I'll have an opening prayer and then the opening idea. Now, today, we've got a lot of show and tell. If you've been with me before, you know, we have things to see and hear and touch and all that. We've also got a very interactive plan. If you've ever been with me, you know that you won't hear me for 50 minutes straight. That's for sure. So we'll read some text. We'll have some ideas, some questions, sharing back and forth, and certainly hope to hear from a large number of you. If you're not inclined to, you know, reading or sharing an idea, that's fine. But we know your ideas are wonderful, and we'd love to hear them. So as a body, I also know that we are on a very good schedule, and I will absolutely adhere to. At 4:10, our break comes, and we're going to last until 4:20. Maybe 4:22 if you slip me $5, but you know it'll go up there. You know, minute, a dollar per minute. We can talk. You know, so and such. And we'll be done at 5:30, absolutely. So don't worry about that. So that'll be our structure. You know, I'm sure that Dr. Gehrman has said too. If your back is killing you tonight, or your knee is just not giving you a break, get up, move around. You know, you're still part of our group. If you have to stand in the back or stretch or whatever, step out, come back in. By no means, you know, don't feel trapped and uncomfortable waiting until that 4:10 blessed break. So with that in mind, let's do an opening prayer and then dive into it. Heavenly Father, thank you. It's a beautiful afternoon, the sun, the wind, and all of that. Thank you that fall has come in all its color. Give us what we need for this fall. Give farmers the good weather that's needed for them to do the work in the field. Give travelers the safety that they need. Give students here the schooling, the education experience that they need for this fall. Be with us in all our work and all our ways. Be especially as we look at Romans. You tell to a waiting, needing world the central message, forgiveness. Hold that up as the heart of the matter. Help us to see the facets and dimensions of this forgiveness and the change that it makes in the lives of Christians. All this we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. Well, as you have been looking up, you see we've got in the back, and I'll just start it here. There's no good video here to this one. But if you know at all, one of my absolute favorite groups from the 70s and on, the Eagles, and the lead singer, Don Henley, famous for this song, among many others, Heart of the Matter. By the way, I'm just going to fill you in on this one. It's a story, a song about a relationship gone bad. And he is singing to the woman that he used to be in relationship with. They've broken up. She's with somebody else. And this is his chance to say one last parting message as she is moving on. I'm going to let the fellas sing on for a little bit. Heart of the matter, forgiveness, forgiveness. Even if you don't love me anymore. Now that's a magnanimous forgiveness, isn't it? It's not a forgiveness based on what have you done for me lately. It's not a forgiveness based on promising to never do it again. It's forgiveness. Even if you don't love me anymore. When we go to Romans, we have a single action forgiveness initially. That is, God says, I know how you are. We're going to look at that at chapter 3, just real briefly. I know how things are going between you and me. And you talk about a broken relationship. This song isn't even anywhere close to the brokenness of our relationship with God. And yet, what's the heart of the matter? What's the heart and the center of his message to us in Romans from 4 on? Forgiveness. Heart of the matter. forgiveness. So with that one in the background, and I hope, by the way, I hope this is one of those songs that kind of sticks in your mind a little bit, because I like the chorus, I like the sound of it. And here, let me get it one more time. There we go. All right. We appreciate that from the Eagles. We'll pull that. They probably never thought of themselves as a theological resource, but that's okay. Now, with that being said, here's our handout for today. And the opening of this, you'll see that I just wrote, Don Henley had it right with his song about da-da-da, the heart of the matter. So all that is what we just did at the top. There you go. And with that, we're going to run to the foundation of our chapters four on. Yeah, there you go. Thanks. Maybe I better peel one for myself. And that is, our theme is built on the context of failure to keep the commandments and our determinedness, and God determined to bring us forgiveness outside of any love or promises we might make. And here is the heart of the matter of God, forgiveness. All right, all that being said. Now, if you have your text open, I'd like you to turn quickly to chapter 3. I know we're studying chapter 4, but before we can get to this wonderful story of forgiveness, we've got to see, do we need it? And golly, chapter 3 makes it pretty clear we sure do. So would you quickly go with me, chapter 3, and if somebody could read, oh, the how are things going in our relationship with God? Could somebody give us, oh, how about just verses 10? Why don't we just go, oh, 10 to 18. Could somebody read that, please? 10 to 18, how's our relationship? There you go. How are things going? Well, here's my analogy, the junk drawers. Here, come on in. I think we've got extra handouts there. They'll get them to you and such. The junk drawer. I hope you can join me in being human. Do you have a junk drawer? I have multiple junk drawers. I just emptied part of one. All right, a junk drawer. All right, define junk drawer. What do you find in junk drawer land? I'm bold. I'm starting to hold that. Why I have an Apple Core thing, I have no idea. But it's in the junk drawer that I just emptied out here to get it. What's in your junk drawer? One bent old spoon. I don't know why. There you go. A little thing from something. I don't know. Literally, I don't know what it is from. What do you think? I don't know. It's in there. An old tape measure. If you want to look at this, the old girl. Is this old or what? Holy cow. Isn't that it? I think it's Western Auto. Yeah, Western Auto Supply. Isn't that fun? I know. Look at that. Whoop, we should pass that around just for novelty. And say, old tape measure. Quick, what's in your junk drawer? Just be honest. Staplers. I got the whole box of staples for you. Exactly. I'm with you. What else you got? Oh, never enough of those. Twist ties. Absolutely. My wife has a whole little kind of a ceramic duck with full of twist ties. Absolutely. What else? Oh, you're my kind of man. I can guarantee you that these markers are dried up. Yeah. But they worked so well once. You know, yeah. Yes, yes. Dead things. Yeah, dead things. What else is in your junk drawer? Yeah. But I don't know where they belong. And just in case I ever need this.
Yeah, that's
what? I have no idea. So look, during break, extra kudos to whoever. Maybe an extra 5 minutes of break if you can tell me what this is, you know, and such. I know, it's the strangest thing. Now, here's the thing. And by the way, this is absolutely a true experience from last week, but something in there you need. My at-home junk drawer had a pull for a slider for a zipper. You know, here. You know what I'm saying? On my motorcycle, not the jacket, but the pants, the zipper, of course, has the slider, this big YKK this right here. When the zipper fails, it's probably just the slider. I knew that in my junk drawer at home, guess what I knew I had? I had a spare slider. Don't you know that feeling? Oh, trust me, I did. Don't you know that feeling? It was here. I can see it. I know it. It should be. You can tell where this story is going, can't you? Did not find it. Did not find that. And can you see it? Still, you can always been there. When you don't need it, oh, yeah, in the way of the things that you were looking for. But last week, I took out that drawer, which is twice the size of this one. What did I do to look for that slider, which I did need? Dumped it out. Everything. Holly was trying to have some conversation with me. Huh? I was completely gone because I need this slider. Didn't find it. So put it all back in the junk drawer. Went away for about an hour, thought about it, looked someplace else, da-da-da. What did I do a second time? Go back to the junk drawer. Exactly. Went back to the junk drawer. Why? It's got to be in here. Emptied it out a second time. By the way, never did find it. Quick call to Duluth, Minnesota, where these are made. Can you send me a slider? Sure. Okay, that's good. It came. I fixed it yesterday. Here's the good news. That's us. Well, really, it's bad news. I think chapter 3 is us looking through the junk drawer of all that we've done, looking for, well, look at the verses you just read. What are we hoping to find? But by the way, the answer from God will be, not there. Look at those verses you just read. What are some of the things we're looking through the junk drawer of our lives and we're hoping to find? Now, again, you're doing this in the negative because God is saying there is none. You're just taking the positive. We're looking for, you need the sound. Junk drawers are noisy. Yeah. Righteousness. It's got to be in here somewhere. I used to have it. Genesis chapters 1 and 2 said I used to have it. Keep on going. Understanding. You'd think I would know better by now. It's ought to be here, right? Exactly. What else? Keep looking at that. There's a whole list of them. We're rattling around. How about this one? Simple good. Look at it. No one does good. Look at verse 12. There ought to be some good in here. Rattling around in our junk drawer. What does he finally get us to the point of by the time he gets us to verse 18? After we've emptied out the junk of our lives and all the places we looked for good, what is he finally just going to sum us up with by the time we're done? No fear of God. None. It's done. I just wonder how often we spend our lives rattling through the junk drawer of our past, imagining, sure of, there ought to be something good, understanding, fear of God, something that would qualify us in the sight of God. And his answer in the end is nothing. Worthless. It's all junk. And in fact, he would pry it out of our hands at this point and say, would you stop rattling through that? Would you stop going through? Think of how many people you've met whose life is an endless pursuit of rattling about in the junk of their lives, looking for something to impress God with. And God is trying to pry it out of their hands and saying, you know what? Number one, there is no good. You're never going to find it. I've got it someplace else for you, but it isn't there. So we're going to put the junk drawer aside. I think by the end of chapter 3, he said, that's all it is. There's no good in it. Well, where do we go? Okay, well, that's chapter 4 then. So let's go to where there's hope. Chapter 4, we find it in one man. By the way, biblically, this is a wonderful thing that we're going to see over and over again. Biblically, you'll see this. We have a broad opening statement, something like what you just saw in chapter 3. Speaking of all the world, there's no good. There's no one righteous. No one has done the right thing, right? The broad statement. And then, right here. Then we come quickly down to just one man and one life, Abraham. We're going to see this pattern over and over again. We're going to see it coming down another way. But it's a wonderful, let me tell you then the one man story. And from that one man, we're going to again break out and touch us all. So let's go to our man Abraham. To do that, a little bit of reading. Oh, how about, would somebody give us chapter 4? How about if we just go through that Old Testament quote, chapter 4, verses 1 to 8. Would somebody read? Anna, thank you so much. When you bring up Abraham, Paul doesn't have to take us back to take in all that Abraham is and does. We bring that with us. As Bible readers, Abraham, question number one, what aspects of Abraham's life make him a prime candidate to demonstrate faith? Again, Paul won't go through all the episodes of Abraham's life, but we know them. When he says, now, what should we say of Abraham? What episodes of Abraham's life say man of faith? Jim, can I be so bold to just pounce on you? You had a perfect look there. By the way, your son has that same wonderful look. His son sits in the same seat in New Testament class. back row livers. Yeah, da, 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 da. It's okay. Oh, over here. Whoa, I should have doctored. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, no, no. Yeah. How fast can Dr. Gammon get to the front? You know, that's what we want to see here. Jim, when we think Abraham, what are we thinking of? Isaac. Now, when you say Abraham and Isaac, I'm with you. You're thinking of which moment?
Yeah, there's a couple.
But exactly.
As a father.
You betcha. The sacrifice, certainly. Isn't that a manner and moment of faith? 3 days journey, the confidence that God will provide. You know, where is the sacrifice? The Lord will provide. Absolutely. The sacrifice of Isaac. What else says? Now, what should we say of Abraham? When you're thinking the context of faith, you're thinking also, yes. Oh, yeah, yeah, follows. Right, right, follows the direction to leave. Isn't that a marvelous thing? And I love on that one, nothing's going to happen to where he is. See, you know, the context we have often is there's some tragedy, disaster going to come. Leave. Well, that's good. That's a step of faith. But it's even more when, can you imagine the conversation Abraham had with Sarah? Pack up, we're leaving. Where are we going? Don't know. Why are we leaving? God said so. What's going to happen to this place? Nothing. But we're leaving. Isn't that something? Not being pried out by a disaster. You know, every disaster movie you ever saw, the asteroid's going to wipe out the earth. We better move. But simply get up and go. Abraham. When you say Abraham, you're thinking faith. You're thinking also, are there any other moments? Yeah, Anna. Yes, yes. Blessing to all nations. And Anna, especially, blessings to all nations coming through him via the one son, not yet born. Isn't that something? You're going to have the son, and through him, all the nations will be blessed. And the promise also then of land that kind of goes with the leave, and there will be a land to which he can go. Beautiful on that one. I think all those. And now Jim had started this one. Jim, you could, the other one, of course, the sacrifice. But the simple thought that you're going to have a child when you're 100 years old and Sarah is 90 and this is actually going to happen. And yes. I mean, isn't that just remarkable? You're 100 years old. Your wife is 90. You're 90. And you get excited because Kohl's is having a sale on baby clothes. I got to get down and get some. I mean, for me, for my child, that is a remarkable thing. Wouldn't that have shocked a checkout lady at Kohl's if a 90-year-old lady comes in and says, I'm getting these for my son? Yes, I know. Wouldn't that be something? I'd like to see what the customer service reps would do with that. Uh-huh, ma'am, that's good. Okay. But there's our man Abraham. Well, that makes him a prime candidate for demonstrating justifying faith. Now, let's go down to question number five. We won't always, looking at our friend the clock, we won't always have time for every question that I've written out here, and they can take a little time. Plus, we do have show and tell. But question number three, did I say five? Question number three, how does verse 5 introduce a new quality? Would somebody read verse 5 again for us? Chapter 4, verse 5. Would you give us 4 and 5? It's a contrast. 4, the world as we know it. 5, Abraham, oh so different. Chapter 4, verses 4 and 5. Sure, yeah, thanks. Frank. Isn't this a marvelous? What's the new quality that comes relative to Abraham? Well, in 4:4, we all know how that works. You work, you get your pay. Do you say thank you? Well, kind of out of just native niceness, right? When you picked up your paycheck back in the days before direct deposit and you actually went there and got a paycheck. You maybe said thank you, but wasn't there a part of you that said, right, I deserve this. I get it, right? Let's go with verse 5. But to the one who does not work. Now, isn't that an interesting one? But to the one who does not work but believes on the one who justifies the ungodly, his faith is counted as righteousness. What's the easiest job you ever had and still got paid for it? Paid with real money. I want you to get paid real money. Easiest job you ever had and you still got real money. I have never heard that one. That is a great answer. Oh my gosh, retirement. That's beautiful. Thank you. There you go. That trumps all the other ones I'm going to get, I suspect, but beautifully done. When you have one that good, you should just hold that card until the end, because you know you got the ace card. What? Easiest job you ever had, and you still got paid money for it. What else? Yeah, I like these looks. You remember? I just needed some Midland. You know, it wasn't that hard to be a...
I worked at a swimming pool.
So your job was lifeguard? If you're guarding, you just watch them.
Yeah.
There you go. That's good. Did you ever guard and there was an empty pool? No one was there yet?
No,
you didn't. Why would they? That would have been good. I could have used that one, but okay. All right. Easiest job you ever had. Easiest job. And you still got paid. 21 boys. At first glance, somebody would say, oh, poor you. You got all those boys. All right. What age?
First grade.
21 and 7? That's a good age. I'm sure they were good. All right. 21 and 7. Yeah. Jim, the pro teacher back there, is smiling. He's thinking, yeah, yeah. Imagining. Another one. Anna, what's the easiest job you ever had?
Working here.
Oh, are you in the library or where?
Writing center.
Oh, sure. Same thing. Writing center. Nobody comes in. What are you supposed to do? Go out in the hallway, snag somebody and say, hey, you look like you need help. Get in here. You know, right. You're a free woman. There you go. Writing center is up in our learning resource center. No one babysat for sleeping children? Well, imagine babysitting for sleeping children. You know, there you go. That wouldn't be too bad. Right. Well, where am I going with this? Except for retirement, which is right there at the very top of my list, I've asked this question more than once. My favorite answer. Young man said, first week of summer, he was all summer on a construction crew at a building site. His uncle or somebody got him a job. Great. He's sick as a dog the whole first week, and he can't go to work. He lets the foreman know he's not able to come. That's okay. All right, so he shows up on Monday of the second week. Of course, the first week he didn't show up at all. He shows up to the foreman and he says to the foreman, okay, I'm here. Sorry about last week. What do you want me to do? All eager to work. Foreman says, first thing you got to do, go over to the shack. You know, there's always that trailer at every construction site known to man. Go over to the shack, get last week's check. He said, but I wasn't here. Yeah, I know that, but they didn't get the message. They cut the checks for you guys every Friday. And if you don't pick up your check, it'll just screw up the whole system. So go over there and get your check. Now I'm going to suggest, isn't that the ultimate of to the one who does nothing and yet expects to receive? Verse 5. I mean, think of this. Every other job you had, you showed up. I mean, the pool might have been empty, but you were there, right? The writing center, nobody comes in, but you had to. They're not going to pay you if you just sat in your room and said, I'm sure no one's coming. No, right? You got to come. Sleeping children, that's great, but you got to be there for it. This kid is the ultimate to the one who does nothing. Why is faith pictured that way in verse 5? Why is that an essence of faith? And by the way, if you want to use my junk drawer as a sort of a background image, it might work for you. Yeah, why is verse 5, remember the junk drawer, the description of faith? It's trust. Yeah, because what have I done?
Nothing.
I have done, and I mean,
you trusted the word.
Nothing. That's it. That's the only thing. But to the one who does nothing, why else? Look at verse 5. Why is that 5, in so many wonderful ways, the definition, the essence of faith? You've done nothing. And the only thing you've got to show for yourself is the chapter 3 junk drawer, in which you finally realized there's nothing good in here, just the junk of my life, broken, dried up, useless, never was. That's all I got. Also, what do you trust in about this God? You trust that this God is whom? Look at the description of God. It's a wonderful, it takes faith. He's a God who what? Yes, and but his word is what? Notice in verse 5, it's specific. I trust in a God who justifies, declares righteous, the ungodly. Isn't that interesting? His very opposite. He justifies, declares righteous, the very opposite of himself, the ungodly. Isn't that a striking thing? definition of faith? Isn't that a striking definition of being saved? Is that it is a God who declares righteous those who are the opposite, the ungodly, of his very self. Not those near him, not those coming by. And isn't that a wonderful opposite of our Genesis 1 and 2 imagery? We are made in the image of God, which is wonderful, but justification deals with those who are the opposite, the ungodly, not seeking him, and certainly doing nothing. That's our definition of faith. Well, with that, oh, absolutely. In other words, also, why would he need to send someone who comes not to be served, but to serve, to give his life as a ransom, to seek, to after the lost? Absolutely, a little Luke 15 imagery. It's a hard thing to do. But maybe even simply individuals that we know who have come to us from a far way.
That's the way the early church was.
Exactly. I have an opportunity, and I know, Jim, you do too, in education classes. We have people in our classes. I teach the most basic Bible 100 survey of the Bible class who come to us from Saudi Arabia and other areas. They are absolutely in no way Christians when they come to us, but we get them for those 45 precious hours in a semester class, and we get to tell them essentially the story of Jesus. And I had a young woman just this summer who, from Saudi, very, very patient, very kindly taking in the whole story of Jesus. And as soon as we got done, she was flying back to Saudi Arabia. Wonderful. And enough to recognize, too, to come and ask you. Absolutely. Well, it's wonderful. Well, that's our definition of faith. And God who justifies the ungodly, even us, let's go on. Now, we can turn the page here, if you would. We're going to leap ahead to another passage, and we are going to have to be a little selective and turn the page. Also, if you're in the Study Bible, you maybe are turning the page with me. Here it is. Let's do this one. If you would give us verses 13. How about 13 to 18? 13 to 18. 13 to 18 of chapter 4. And it's going to take in a couple of... Jim, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Let's go to question number 5, and that's this verse 16. Notice the interplay between faith and grace. And Jim just read that. Look at verse 16 again. And that's why it depends on faith, that the promise may rest on grace. And so as I say in that question, what is the interplay between faith and grace? Why do the two depend on and demand each other? If you have grace, you have to have faith. If you have faith, you have to have grace. What is the interplay? I am no artist, so I'm just having these crisscrossing arrows of varied color. And if I may put it this way, you can go both ways. If you have faith, it has to be by grace. And conversely, if you're depending on grace, it must be then by faith alone. That works. Why? What is the interdependence of this? Take it either way. If I'm saved by faith only, it's got to be by grace. Or the other way. You can go either way. What have you got? Yeah. Oh, go ahead. A gift. Okay. So if grace, can I go with grace as denoting gift? No, it is. But let me go here with this definition. If I give a brief definition of grace, that is God's bestowing of gift. Gift suggests you didn't earn it, right? Why can I accept this gift only by faith accepts? Why? If it is truly gift, why does it take faith to take that gift? Paul said so. Yeah, exactly. By grace through faith, not of yourselves. It's a gift of God. Lest we boast. And I'm worried about two things if we lack faith accepting this as truly a gift. One, we boast, which clearly says what? We did something, didn't we? Right? Or, who hasn't gotten a, air quote, gift? A gift that suggests what? About the future and the relationship you have with the gift giver. I'm air quoting around gift there again. If you're not boasting that you earned it, you're fearful that you're going to own it. Exactly. Haven't we all gotten those offers of free gifts? Da da da. You know? Yes, yes, yes. Weekend at the lodge, at the resort, at the timeshare, da-da-da. No obligation. Oh, there's a man who, there's a man. Did you go or did you just say, honey, forget it. There's no Forget it, right. There's that. I can live without 3 days of being strong-armed by some. I've never gone to. But we all got that nervousness. So if this is true, if it's truly, truly, truly a gift, you mean a gift, no earning, no deserving, no future obligations, then the only thing that can take that is faith. It takes a lot of faith to imagine a gift with no obligations that's truly undeserved. It takes a lot of faith to accept that, doesn't it? That word. Well, right. Right, exactly, exactly. Right, and now here, let me go on this way. If, go back to our other definition, this is verse 5 a little bit. If faith, that is, which does nothing, remember we talked about that? But to the one who believes, having done nothing, all right, so let's make this an important component of faith. Now, I'm not saying faith is lazy, but faith doesn't come with, look what I did, at all. Faith is empty hands that receives God's gift, not full hands that shows a imaginatory, wealthy box of, look what I did. This is not faith. This is showing, you know, showing off. All right. If faith does nothing, why does faith then depend on grace? Oh, that's exciting. God has the answer. God says, I'll answer. You know, we were in a restaurant yesterday, Holly and I, and a very nice lady was sitting by herself, and the phone went off in a very dramatic manner. And thank you so much for that phone. That was just perfect. It went off in a dramatic, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And she opens it up, and she says, hi, honey, kind of semi-embarrassed. And I thought, I told Holly, now that's what I want on your phone, that when I call, you got, that's what, you know, something like, fantastic, best call all day, da da da. It was cute, you know. Although in the restaurant, she was kind of like, "Oh my gosh," you know. Holly said, "No, it's not going to happen." Oh, that's good. All right, we'll go back to if faith does nothing but receive. If faith is our hands receiving the gift of God, why does that faith depend, therefore, on grace? I'm getting marker all over myself here. Why does that depend on grace? Yes, sir. Yes. Look at what you just wonderfully said. Grace is a sure promise. A promise that is sure, made by, of course, God, not us. Go, go. Oh. Yeah. That would work beautifully, wouldn't it? Always a man trying to find in the junk drawer of his life something that would please God. Finally find, remember that famous Luther image where Luther felt like he was imprisoned finally and that he couldn't find a way out, having rummaged, of course, I suppose, through every part of his life to find some key that would get him out. I should have thrown a key in here and such. Yeah, absolutely. So faith, because it does nothing, depends on a promise surely made by God alone that he accepts us by grace. Because what have I got? A faith that of itself brings nothing except to accept your grace, your offer. On the same hand, faith is what's needed when grace says it's a gift. It's a gift. You've done this with someone, I'm sure. You've given them a gift, and you truly want them to see it as a gift. You don't want them to urgently, frantically start looking around the house for something they can give you back, right? See, I see this. I see this all. You're that. You didn't make that for them. You didn't buy that for them. You didn't bring that souvenir home for them to get something. You just wanted to give a gift. And all you wanted them to do was take it and trust that you meant it. It's really a gift. That's why faith is the natural counterpart to grace and grace to faith back and forth. That's it. Sure, right. Oh, yes. Right. Oh, wonderful.
Many people talk about faith.
Mm-hmm.
Faith in love.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You can always have some general fluffy, you know, having faith And then I've had many a student says, yes, I'm growing in faith in trusting myself and my abilities. That's not exactly where we're going. Yeah, exactly. We've got to go beyond that. All right, we're going to do one more on chapter 4. And by the way, I should have told you this. Our goal is chapters 4 and 5 before the break. And then 6, 7, 8 works beautifully for after the break. So we've got verse here, 18. On your page, it's number 6. And it's one more show and tell. As you would guess, we got to get through a show and tell here on this one. Against hope, Abraham in hope believed. Isn't that a marvelous thing? In the literal rendering of the Greek itself would be, for he, against hope, but upon hope, yet believed. It doesn't make any sense. Let me suggest via show and tell. My show and tell is actually a doubleheader, both having to do with, as you would guess, if you don't know me, my love of motorcycles. I've been riding motorcycles for 46 years. My bike's sitting right there waiting to take me home today. So we're going to talk motorcycles just for a moment. There's a famous motorcycle technical writer, Kevin Cameron. He's been doing this for umpteen years. He was a race mechanic, and he's been the technical editor for the biggest motorcycle magazine in America, Cycle World, for many, many years. Kevin Cameron had a wonderful article once, and he said every destroyed engine he's ever seen had fresh oil in it. For that, I'll just hold up a Honda oil filter. Every destroyed engine, race engine, he's ever seen had brand new fresh oil in it. Thank you very much. I was waiting for somebody to have a, wait a minute. Because when I read that, same thing. That was the opening of the article. What makes you go, huh? Every destroyed engine, the engine blew itself up on the racetrack, had brand new oil in it. What do you think were his point? No, the oil was working just fine. Filter was working just fine. Think about this. This engine was having troubles. This engine had a mechanic who couldn't obviously fix what was impending, the doom that was approaching. So what did that mechanic who couldn't fix the real problem do? He put in new oil. Why did he put in new oil? Oh, we live in hope. Right? I was hoping you would say, you know, you want to say that again by saying, hoping that would fix it, right? Isn't that simple hope? This much he knows how to do. By the way, did changing oil save the engine and fix the problem? No, because it's a faint hope. Now, I'm going to go to my next one, which is screwdriver versus this thing, if you know what this is. This is a simple, cheap screwdriver. This is the kind you find in the bargain bin at the front door of the hardware store. If you live in our little town of Cedar Grove, we've got the old-timey, our own hardware kind of, you know, hardware store. Wonderful place. I love going there. And they got the cheap old bargain bin right at the door. Are you with me? Join me. What kind of tools do you get in the cheap old bargain bin by the door at the hardware store? Yeah, exactly. That's my kind of guy. Exactly. You know, and this one, you can see this one's been used for everything under the sun. And how come it's got so many dents on the side? I don't know, but all right, whatever. All right. If you have, go with me on this one, especially Japanese motorcycles, the engine case screws are literally Phillips screws. If they've been on there for a while and they've gone through innumerable heat, cold cycles, how willing are they to come out? Not so much. So you try, right, with this, right? This screwdriver doesn't work. This one doesn't work. I'll guarantee you, what will you wander around in your toolbox and look for? Another one. Or you'll go down to the hardware store, and what will you buy? Another one, right? Maybe a $2 one. Go high dollar and get the one off the rack instead of in the bin. What do you need? I can just tell you this from old experience. Does anyone know what this is? I wrote it in the sheet, by the way. It's an impact driver. Okay, it's a screwdriver with a replaceable head, okay? And what do you do with it? Why do I have a hammer? You pound on it. And when you pound on an impact driver, I'll try not to shoot this out at you. You whack it like this. It drives that bit into the screw, and it also, because there's an internal cam, what do you think it does? It turns it, just that tiny little bit. Can it cam out? Cam out as in come out? No, because you're smacking it, and you can tell this one's been smacked once or twice. Absolutely, it will come out. Now, stay with me. Against hope, upon hope, Abraham believed. Isn't that a marvelous combination? I'm going to suggest that the initial round of conventional hope doesn't work. against hope. Yet, upon hope, there we go, get it back in there, but upon hope, at a different level, at a different severity, and maybe, in fact, out of his hand, Abraham believed. Think about that. Isn't that a marvelous contrast? Are we at times confronted with the promises of God that at first glance are against hope? Oh, think about, I took Abraham down. Wouldn't the promise of having a child at 100 years old be against hope? Exactly. Will conventional wisdom or means get this done? No, not on your life. And so against hope, yet upon hope, that distinctive hope that only God can create, the hope in his extraordinary promise and his work, not ours, there you go. Because I think the great divide between these is, I've tried, and God smiles, I know you have. It didn't work, and God smiles and says, I know it didn't. But don't you have to go on to the other side, and God says, let me show you what I can do. And faith accepts what God does against hope, but yet upon hope. You know, I like that phrase. I think there's a lot of life in that. I'll bet you all of us in life, in relationships, in family, in work, in health issues, have made a journey from against hope and yet upon hope. The conventional hope. You did everything right. They made every promise. And sometimes all that hope hasn't worked. And yet upon hope, we still are people of hope. We still trust in one who goes beyond the things that haven't worked out. Even though we're ready to say to God, but God, I tried. And God, I'm sure, puts an arm around our shoulders and says, oh, I know you did. But let me give you upon hope still. It's a wonderful phrase. Just enjoy that Abraham passage in 4:18. All right, there's our chapter 4 and our hopefulness. Let's go to chapter 5. I just got to say we got to keep going a little bit here always in our drive forward. And for that, we need my opening question, the plateau of peace. Would somebody read chapter 5, verses 1 through 5, while I clear our board? Here's our two hills with a valley in between. And why can't we stay on the plateau of peace? So look at this, is chapter 5, verse 1, isn't it? Having been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Wouldn't you love Paul to just stop right there? Wouldn't you love to just say, like some perfect vacation, let's just stay. Just stay. Why don't we just stay? I'm hoping you've had a vacation moment, a perfect camping site, the perfect place that you went to. You were visiting with friends or the family. Everything was perfect. Everything was going along. Why don't we just stay right here? But then Paul takes us down, doesn't he? And he says, but more so, we rejoice in our tribulations, for tribulation produces, are somebody with me on verse 3? Endurance, exactly. And endurance produces character, a proven character. And character produces hope, for the hope does not disappoint. Isn't that a daring phrase? Hope does not disappoint. Don't you want to come up to Paul and say, let me tell you, I've seen it. But hope does not disappoint, for the love of God has been poured forth in our hearts. Join me on this one. Why would we like to just stay on the plateau of peace and just say, can we just stop right here? Just imagine camping on the rim of the Grand Canyon, a great view, solid footing. Why don't we just stay right here, God? Why would we love that? Let's end Romans at 5:1. Having been justified by faith, we have peace with God. Call her done. No stress. Doesn't that sound lovely? It does. I just want to sit, watch the sunrise over the canyon, over the hill, and just go, catch my breath, have a little more coffee off the... When we go camping, we bring out the old percolator, set it on the edge of the campfire. Oh, man, that is good stuff. Just sit there. Doesn't that sound nice? But, of course, Paul says, we got to go. We're going to make this trip. So why does God take us on a trip and says, and not just we got more to go, but... And Paul says, more than that, we rejoice in our tribulation, for tribulation produces endurance, endurance, character, character, hope. and the love of God is poured into our hearts. Why does God take us on that journey of verses 3, 4, and 5? What, and think about these as lead-in ideas, if you would. What do you find only here that you can't see up here? I'm going with sort of a canyon idea. You know, you're on the edge, the rim of the Grand Canyon, and you want to stay up here? And he says, no, we're going to go down here. So what only do you find or see down there that you're not going to up here? And where are you going to arrive that's a far place from where you were and wanted to stay? And you might well have a third one. So he said, yeah, go. Hit it. Yeah, exactly. See, right now, I'm at a place that I think is as high and good as it possibly can get. I'm justified by faith and I'm at peace with God. Done. And God says, we've got more. There's a higher place yet you can't imagine. But I like where I'm at. Yeah, oh, see, there it is. I don't yet have, what have I not yet perhaps seen? Some of these, finally maybe even that. Or the daring to say hope that doesn't disappoint. Isn't that a pretty gutsy thing to say to our world? I know a hope that doesn't disappoint. Talk to a world that says, oh, every hope I've had hasn't come through. Keep on going. Why do I take this journey? What am I going to find or see? Where might I arrive? Why does he take me down this trip? Oh, depth. Depth of life. That's beautiful. Depth of life. Also, who am I with when I take that journey? There's more than one answer to that. Yeah, exactly. Don't I find him here? Yes, but I was with you up here, God. Yes, you were. You were at peace with me. But you're with my strength when you're in tribulation and endurance. Isn't that interesting, the difference? Here I have God's peace. Here I have his strength with me. Keep on going. There is that danger, isn't there? Isn't it easy to somehow forget grace and faith, the emptiness of our junk drawer, if we simply stay up here? I don't have that desperate need of his strength unless I'm down here. Keep on going. I also ask, who are you with? And God is right. But who also might I meet when I'm down here that I might not meet yet here? Oh, there's that. I might have to face a difficulty, a temptation down here. But think also the people who desperately find themselves in this place in life and are only here. You know, if we only live on a plateau of peace, distant from those who are in difficulty and trouble, we can wish them well. We say, I sure wish you were up here. Too bad you're down there. Hope you find a path up here. Wouldn't it be better if we also had an experience with them down here? And, when we describe their life in terms that say our life's not so different. I always found that so one of my favorite stories here is because our family's not perfect in any way. I love asking this one. It's a true story. Two Thanksgivings ago, our son, daughter-in-law came home, and they brought their dog. And we had a wonderful, wonderful black lab, best dog ever. They brought their boxer, slightly demented boxer. Again, we're not a perfect family, and we don't always get everybody together. And we're all together, trapped, you know, relatively trapped. It's Thanksgiving. There's no getting out. There's no escape. You know, the weather wasn't that good. So why are you glad to have two dogs in the living room on Thanksgiving Day who really, really, really don't like each other? Because they had two actual knockdown, drag-out dog fights in the middle of the living room over the course of the day. Do you know why you want that? No matter how bad we're getting along, we look better than the dogs. That's our family. All right? We're not perfect people. Now, that's a true story. And really, they still have that crazy dog. I can show you pictures during break. Of that dog. But anyway, join these folks because your life is there too sometimes. No offense, your family isn't perfect either. You've got tribulation. There's dates on your calendar you're a little afraid of when they come. Da-da-da. Because we're here and we're there. What about these? What is God showing us in this final ascending that I wouldn't simply have on the plateau of peace? What is he showing me? Oh, absolutely. How did you ever get up here? Well, a proven character, doesn't that sound like there's something marvelous about me? No, no. It's the endurance of his strength has shaped and molded to give me hope that demonstrates finally what do I get to see through that journey that isn't simply here on the plateau of peace. Exactly. Which answers and a question the world is always going to ask us, how can you possibly have a hope that doesn't disappoint? And that's a pretty gutsy thing to say, isn't it? Not mine. Not because I've got this perfect plan or I live with these perfect people or I live in a perfect world. But there's a God who's, this is my hope, demonstrates his love in and through what's happening. Yeah. Not that the world is perfect or me, but he demonstrates his love even in that journey. So there's chapter 5, that wonderful opening of 1 through 5 as we go on that plateau heading up. Well, that's, as you can see, verses or questions we could do 1, 2, 3, and 4, a good long section of that. Let's go on. Let's go on. If you're on page 4, we've got to look at our friend the clock. We're perfect. If you would give us, would somebody give us verses 6, 7, and 8? Now at chapter 5 again, we're on chapter 5. Verses 6, 7, and 8 should be a nice chunk there in your reading. 6, 7, and 8. Beautifully. Our question number 5 says, in verses 6, 7, and 8, Paul reassures those who worry that their walk of suffering, character, and hope, those middle steps there, may not succeed. How do verses 6, 7, and 8 calm our fears, lest our suffering isn't always victorious? In other words, if you're right here in the midst, and we are all right here in the middle, how do verses 6, 7, and 8 speak to the people right here in times of endurance and character being shaped and hearing the first words of hope? What do these words have to say to the worried ones in the middle? They're not sure. They're still in being developed in endurance, still being shaped in character. What does this say to their worries? We have a natural worry. Right. Oh, right. See, Chloe, you had perfect. It's not only just, well, God, I'm not there yet. Aren't we tempted to make what as the condition of being saved? But I'll make it, exactly, but just give me time. You know, oh, I slipped back a little bit like a bad diet, you know, and then you went back again. Not that any of you need the diet. And such. I told opening at the start of the school year, I said one of my summer goals was to lose 5 pounds without any effort or pain on my part. And I'm happy to say there has been absolutely no pain or effort on my part. Very proud of that. Since I haven't stepped on a scale in months, I'm not even worried about that whole 5 thing, you know. But So we make promises relative to that's what's going to get me up. Chloe, you said it again. Say it perfectly. To my inclination to promise making to God, what's his answer in 6, 7, and 8? Well, exactly. But remember, our relationship isn't based on your promises. It's not based on your checkup, your numbers. I loved you, for this is the amazing thing, isn't it? Perhaps for a righteous man, someone might dare to die, verse 7. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Whom? The ungodly. Isn't that a marvelous thing? Pure grace. And there, by the way, doesn't that take then its counterpart, pure faith, is the only thing that'll fit and wrap around it. Yeah. If you want that, you need the empty hands of faith alone to take the uniquely pure grace gift. I save the ungodly. I save those who have nothing. And then we say, well, that would be me. And God smiles and says, of course, that's you. That's who I came to save. So verses 6, 7, and 8, I think, are the natural word needed to the middle land right here, moving from tribulation on through and shaped character, and sometimes a slip back, and then we slip up, and we hold on to hope, but sometimes we slide, and he gives us this certainty that I save the ungodly. Well, let's keep on going. We got another one. Now, verses 9 and 10. Would somebody give us 9 and 10, please? Verses 9 and 10. What is more? My question number six says verses 9 and 10 seem to distinguish the salvation derived by Christ's death and one by his life. But, of course, we know there's one salvation. What does Christ do by his death and what by the life? It's not that there's two salvations, not a stage one, stage two, anything like that. And we know that his life and death and resurrection are all a whole, a one. So what's he suggesting is the all the more, having been justified by blood, will be saved from wrath? What is more, by his life? What reassurance, in other words, comes to us by his death? What comes to us by his resurrected life? Certainly. And you have a wonderful one. And we're going to find that, not in Romans as much, but 1 Corinthians 15. If Christ is not raised, we're still in our sins. We're of all men most to be pitied, but if God has raised him, we too walk in newness of life. Absolutely. His resurrected life says you're going to live. Also, doesn't it say something about those who've gone before us? Right? They are alive and well. I love to, and Anna knows this, I love to speak of in my class about my parents. They're long gone, but they're in heaven. Isn't that a marvelous certainty about those that you love and know died in the faith? And don't worry, I don't have visions or see them or anything like that, but we know they're in heaven because of his life. They live too. And my mother is drinking coffee in heaven like there's no tomorrow and commenting that, man, it's really good up here. But my mother lived for coffee. She truly lived for coffee. Anna, what else? What comes to us distinctly by his death? What comes to us uniquely also by his life? Exactly. If by his death, he has given his life as a ransom for us all. Isn't that a wonderful death imagery? So by his death, you've been, a Pauline passage, bought with a price, right? Those wonderful images of purchased, won, paid for, debt covered, all images of his payment by his blood. But then by his resurrection, what does he say about today and tomorrow in your life and walk? Right, and he wants to join you in that day and day and day and day walk. I mean, it's wonderful news, isn't it, to say I've been purchased, I've been paid for, I've been won. Those are great images of by his death. I've been ransomed by his death, all good. And then he comes and says, and I live to walk with you. And I will live to walk with you to every single day. Isn't that a marvelous thing? I need his life, too. Yeah. Yeah, Jim, yeah. No. Exactly. Wouldn't this be sad and so tragic? Oh, Jim, join me on this one. I hate a movie where the hero dies. Don't send me there. No. Isn't that why you go to James Bond movies? There's no way they're killing off the whole James Bond franchise by killing off Bond. I don't care how they get him out, but by golly, he's going to live. Our hero lives, having paid the price, yet he lives. Well, we've got one just intro on this one, and we're not going to finish it. I'm not treading over the 410 cut line. I don't know how to find out what happens if you go over 410, but I've been told it's bad. It's bad. And so would you quickly read with me verses 12 and following? Well, I tell you what, why don't you give us 12, 13, and 14, and we'll get started on, I'm going to make a list here for us, the Adam Christ, the first Adam, second Adam imagery. Would somebody get us started reading verses 12, 13, and 14? You betcha. And you're looking at the text that follows. We'll just get started and we'll have our break. What is, and mostly it's a contrast, but you might have a similarity between Adam and then the new Adam, Christ. What do they in opposite bring to the world or their method of work? And in many ways, it's opposites. Death. Exactly. Here, this one, by the sin of one man comes death, and by another comes eternal life. Exactly. Keep on going. Yes, the fall. Now, was that Jim? I don't know. Yeah. Jim, the fall encompasses by what? By, right, one act. Right, by one act. Isn't this interesting? Now, go with me on this happy opposite. How are we redeemed? It's a both. There is a by one act. By his voluntary death. We just were doing that one. That we are then ransomed, paid for, redeemed by his death. But we are also saved by his, exactly, by his life. And that, of course, is ongoing and a you know, extended. So isn't that an interesting contrast? By Adam's singular fall, we all tumbled into fallen nature. Exactly. We're redeemed by that, by both a singular death, but also by his perfect life leading to that death and his ongoing life resurrected from the dead. Isn't that an interesting balance and difference? Keep on going. Anything different between them? Oh, but it's so good. Adam had a perfect wife, right? Did I get that? And Jesus had the perfect life. Oh, my heavenly days. And with that, it's 4:10. We got to stop right there. Holy cow. That's fantastic. We take our 10-minute break. We'll come back. We won't do better, but we'll come back. You know, I promise nothing better than that. Fantastic. Take your break.